Hello, friends, and welcome to another episode of Just Another Kill Team Podcast, connecting Kill Team communities across the globe. Your hosts today are me, I'm Jason.
And I'm Travis, regular co-hosts.
We connect with all sorts of different people, TOs, competitive players, and just anyone else that has something interesting to say that they message us and convince us to talk about on an episode.
Yeah, we do like making the world a little bit smaller, one hobbyist at a time.
We do have a Discord and a Patreon, which is definitely some stuff that you should check out if you enjoy our content.
And if you do enjoy this podcast, make sure to share it with your friends who play Kill Team, because the more, the merrier.
In today's episode, we interview Alvaro, who was 10th place overall at Adepticon playing Warp Coven. Let's see what Zeench has in store for us today.
We're back with the newly buffed king of the meta, the Warp Coven.
Yeah, serendipity coming along. It was all in Zeench's plans.
just
after Adepticon.
You just had to lose. The poor Warp Coven players just had to lose for 2 years. But the time is now.
And even pre-buff Alvaro here, you did really well at Adepticon.
Oh, thank you. To be honest, I was personally a bit disappointed with my end run. I was feeling like I had a shot at the top 8. But then, yeah, I got matched against Rob Poirier.
Oh, yes.
The local menace. Yeah, and then I lost by 1 point on the first game, and I was like, there's so little chances of getting to that top 8.
All right, well, we're here to talk Warp Coven with the top placing Warp Coven in the U.S., I think, right now, as of last weekend. Alvaro, yeah. Right?
Yes. Hi.
Okay. Yeah, even before we got on to catching up with you, Alvaro, you know, Warp Coven has been doing kind of well the last couple of weeks as far as me and Jason's week-to-week show has been concerned. Hitting 70% last weekend in Spain, and it sounds like, you know, you did pretty well. You only had 2 losses, right?
Yes, I lost my first game at the Adopticon GT. And my first game in the second bracket.
Yeah. All right. And, you know, coming hot off the heels of last week's data slate change, Warp Coven are off to a new start.
Because
it's becoming out on Monday. The data slate will have happened last Wednesday. And how are you feeling about the buffs?
My first thoughts is that it makes the band much easier to pilot and much more forgiving. So I totally see the intent to make the band more approachable to new people, make it more more tempting to be something to try out next. However, the end result to me was that it feels like the band will be a little bit less fun. I read the change to make the Exalted a starter strategic ploy a bit odd. Making it free it's kind of like, it sounds like it should be like a built-in rule into the team, if that's the case. I guess you have an extra benefit of it being an extra strategic ploy. You get one more round to do something for free, which is always good. But yeah, it makes me think, it's like, maybe they are just throwing stuff at the wall and see what sticks.
For listeners who don't know what happened to Warp Coven, the Exalted Astartes ploy, which has gotten buffed a couple times, I think, from when the team was released, is now all sorcerers and gunners, or all operatives that are not Zangors, can now double fight and double shoot. Sorcerers specifically, if they shoot with different profiles. And it used to cost 1 CP, and now costs 0 CP. So basically every turn, all the operatives that are marine chassis are dangerous on Warp Coven. Especially because their gunner is probably one of the scariest guns in the game, right?
The gunner is pretty solid. Rubrics are pretty solid too, anyway. The problem with the gunner is that his second shot costs 2 actions. So you have to be very, very conscious about where you place him. The Rubric Icon Bearer and the Rubric Marine Warriors, for example, they just have a weapon similar to a bolt rifle. And they can just move and shoot. So that's also something that people tend to overlook that is pretty good because those rifles have AP1. So you can put in a good show by just turning a corner, guns placing, and have fun. Also, like Jason survived recently in my match against him, in the sense that one of his foes survived two shots of the gunner in straight in the face. So it's quite a swingy weapon.
Yeah, six dice on threes, 3/4, AP1, and it can double shoot if you stand still, which is generally somewhat hard to get into a good position and double shoot. But Warp Coven, they do have one sneaky ploy where your sorcerer can warp portal a gunner up onto a vantage point, and now it's in position to double shoot, right?
Yes, but it also works the same way in Into the Dark.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a telegraph move because you have to be tossing that gun around with your Warpfire Sorcerer, which is the one that can teleport other units, so the opponent can definitely know what you will be doing the next turn. But given that the Rubrics tend to be very resilient against weapons with normal damage base 3, which causes their saves to be 2+, you can be confident that you will put the Rubric in a position where he can get a line of sight somewhere and survive one activation from the opponent to then get some retaliation.
And this is basically you shoot and then go on guard on In the Dark, right? Because you can
I typically take two shots if I can.
Yeah, because you'll teleport him into a place where he can double shoot.
Yeah. I occasionally try to position him so that I take two shots. And then if it survives, potentially take an overwatch.
Mm.
So I might want to do that teleporting late in my turn. So that, again, the delivery can survive maybe one or two activations and then go on overwatch. So that would be three shots on a turn.
So how often do you take, like, do you ever take zero Zangors? Or like, do you, like, what's the most you take? And like, what's the spread here and why?
Oh, that's a great question. I wanted to go about that in the Total Days change because I really liked the change of adding one wound to Zangors in the data slate. That is very good into matchups like Felgors. Because Felgors have a chain sword with normal damage 4, crits on 5s, and if they don't get you crits, it means that your Zangor might get 3 die. So that's pretty solid, and it makes them even more of a menace in Into the Dark guarding a door. So that's that was a welcome change on my end. As for the spread, most of the times I'm running 2 Zangors, 3 Sorcerers, and 2 Rubrics. Depending on the matchup, I might flex into 4 Zangors or 6 Zangors. For example, if I'm facing Breachers, I would take 4 Zangors on most layouts because you only need 2 hits of melee from a Zangor to kill the regular Breachers. Or maybe if they are like one of the few 9 wound operatives, just a crit and a normal is fine. And I've even used this Warp Coven ploy that allows Zangors to retain a crit if they are in combat support from another Zangor. So I might pair 2 Zangors, 3 inches from each other to not be blasted so easily. Then maybe do a chain activation of Zangors with attack ploy, assuming I play the strat ploy to retain a crit. That works pretty well to shred through 8-wound models. So again, very sensitive to the layout, to the opponent.
Are you thinking about maybe taking more Zangors now that they've changed Zangors to have 9 wounds? Or do you feel like this is just a nice buff to the situations where you would take Zangors because the Marines are now so much more efficient compared to how they used to be?
Yeah, I'm always thinking on the 2-6 spectrum. This makes the option to take 6 Zangors much more tempting. But again, it kind of depends on the damage profiles that I will be matched against. Sometimes I depend a lot on the rubric icon bearer, so I will always take it on most of the matches, because my playstyle really depends on getting lots of spells early in my turn. So it's very hard for me to take 6 Zangors, and if I don't need those spells, that's when I would consider these 6 Zangors and having the extra wound might work. Again, if I don't need the spells, for example, if I rely a lot on casting my blast spells early in the turn from the sorcerer with the Temperic Discipline, I might not take it and go into 6 Zangors. That sounds potentially a matchup like Intercession, where Zangors might be more interesting, but against the damage profile of like 3 base damage, it doesn't come that much. Maybe they survive one more crit. That's kind of very, very, very light stats. Probably Intercession and Phobos, like that's where 6 Zangors will be more valuable than an extra spell.
Yeah, especially against Phobos because they have 12 wounds. A Zangor on a bad day for a Phobos 12 wound operative might actually take enough damage where he dies.
Yeah. I've had great success with the Zangors with blades that have Relentless, guarding Ador against.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen a player who takes a ton of pistols on the Zangors, even though a bunch of the equipment are kind of for the Zangors with pistols.
Oh, I actually run them.
Okay, all right. Yeah, what situations are you running the auto pistol on? Do you take the equipment when you run it?
Yes, I definitely have tried 2 Zangors with the equipment that gives their pistols ceaseless and improves their damage. That's, I believe, ensorcelled rounds for the damage improvement. I don't know what's something about the magazines that gives them ceaseless. And it's mostly when I'm thinking about chain activations and when I'm running 6 Zangors, because I would take a shot with a Zangor fighter with a pistol and charge and chain activate another Zangor to charge. So I get some cheap damage in very early before the fight, and maybe a Zangor champion just shreds through a big model that already had 3 or 4 damage on it. So definitely something to consider on when I'm running 6 Zangors.
All right. And are you enjoying, or how do you feel like the new changes to the spells are going to go? Because you were talking about how you wanted to make sure that you get spells off at the correct time. Now all of your spells last until the beginning of your operative's next activation. So all of your curses and your temporal or ephemeral instability and your defensive buffs, those all last until your next activation, effectively. So you can kind of keep those up for much longer than you were able to in the past, right?
Oh, yeah. Definitely is an opportunity to, for example, take an early activation to cast Ephemeral Instability and then do not activate the sorcerer until late into the next turning point, which means that you get some extra value from that. Although I think that that particular spell is offset because the Deadless Day just reduced its benefit. For example, Ephemeral Instability before reduced the length of charges and dashes by 2 inches. Now it does by 1. So you might get it to run for longer, but for the same costs, but slightly weaker. It might not sound like much, but in many, many layouts, those 2 inches means that some operative can at most, in Into the Dark, get within 1 inch of the door and open it. I believe actually that's what happened with my matchup against Jason here in Adepticon. I cast Ephemeral Instability and it posed a very difficult question for him. It's like, I will be just on turning point one, just reaching the door. But with the X range, you can reach the door and actually get some visibility into the room. So that makes that spell much less valuable to get early on. As for the buffs, I'm running them anyway. I value them a lot. So it's definitely nice to be able to have, for example, the buff for rerolling defense die last longer. And it's definitely nice to get the debuff to opponents where you can reroll all attacks onto them. Like, you can cast it late on one turn, and your next activation, the next one, gets some rerolls with a big blast. So that's always nice. However, I find also some potential for confusion, because I typically run this equipment called like the Knowledge Tome or Arcane Tome, where you can learn the spell from another sorcerer. Mm-hmm. And I typically run it so that I have Ephemeral Instability on two sorcerers on open, so that I can pick which one to activate first and cast it. And this might mean that I cast it on one turn with one sorcerer, and then the next one I cast it with the other one, so I have both instances on at once.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, because this now creates an extra layer, so you maybe can have a room where it's permanently on, because the cast is distinct, and I think the wording on the cast is you cannot cast a spell that has been cast on this turning point.
Exactly.
But that's now you can cast Ephemeral Instability on turning point one, and then cast on two, and then just kind of chain it indefinitely. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. So, and if you stack both, I would assume that both instances in parallel add up to reducing it. So if I have both instances up, the first one reduces it by one, the second by an additional one. That's potentially something that will be need to be clarified in an FAQ.
Yeah, that sounds like this would probably be a good errata.
Yeah.
Okay, hold on. Or until the psychic power is selected again. Okay. I think that's actually, no, it's actually there. In psychic powers, it says until it's activated again. So even though it's the same spell, it gets reactivated and it replaces the old one. So I think it's actually resolved there.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Even better.
So we're good. All right. Anyone who's listening and was worried about Warp Coven being even more complicated, it's fine. You just only get to move one less inch.
Yeah. Even better.
But then Arcane Robes, you know, now your three sorcerers are going to play closer to like 14, 15 wounds rather than the 13 wounds they currently represent, which for anyone who's played against Intercessors knows that 15 wounds is definitely a scary breakpoint.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely makes the Arcane Robes an insta pick.
Yep.
Before, I actually felt like it wasn't always something that I would consider. Sometimes I might go with the item that gives feel no pain on mortal wounds,
mm-hmm.
depending on the matchup, because the sorcerers tend to attract all the snipers, all the meltas. But right now, yeah, it feels like Arcane Robes will be a definitely superior pick.
So I've got a question about the TAC ops that you choose. You've got access to security and recon, is it? And mm-hmm. you get another one with the Zangors. What do you typically play for TAC ops?
Sorry, what was that about the Zangors?
Do Zangors give you extra options for your TAC ops? Or
no, it's just security. It's just security and recon. It used to be it was based around how many Zangors you took.
Oh, yeah. That's, yep.
Yeah,
and that's been removed. Yeah. Okay, yeah, it was removed, I think, last patch.
Yeah. Or maybe before, but yeah, they changed. The last time Warp Coven was changed, you could choose Recon or Security regardless of what you bring into the table,
mm-hmm.
right? So I believe that remains the same. I think that both have a place, both Recon and Security, in the kind of kill team selections I make. And I use that also as an opportunity to surprise my opponent. Because sometimes my opponent looks at a layout and they think, oh, these rooms look like super tempting. I'm pretty sure this Warp Coven player I'm matched against will go for like secure center line, will go for recon and secure and explore rooms. Right? Mm-hmm. Like recover item and all of those. And in that layout, in since you play the layout, maybe secure center line and secure the center are just as good.
And they let you play, kill your opponent's models while you are angling for position on the board, rather than having to set models out on recon objectives that may or may not be in useful positions, right?
Yeah, and also the other way, some opponents on an open layout might see a big vantage on the center. They might see like the Octarius pump and say, okay, the easy thing to do is to go for seize ground and secure center, secure the center. And it's very easy and it's very tempting, but sometimes you have enough terrain so that recon is also as easy and they don't expect it. That is, I believe, something that Warcoven is very good at, is surprising the opponent, trying to come up with a game plan that works and allows you to be creative with the positioning of your operatives. So I think that, both.
Yeah, so you switch it up pretty often.
Yeah, I do. So kind of 50-50. And even on the same layout. Yeah, mm-hmm. And even on the same layout, depending on who's attacker or defender, if I know one defender, I might just go security. And if I'm attacker, I would go for recon. Just based on that.
It gets even that granular, huh? Can you talk about one of the, what kind of boards have made your decision that granular? So you've said attacker, defender, but like specifically what matchup are you worried about when you have to set up and your opponent knows where you are? When are you changing your TACOP selections? Because Warp Coven is one of those teams where, because you have all these options, it's very hard for players to kind of get a handle on where their mistakes are. Because it could be that you're making mistakes very early, like on TACOP selection, or maybe it's just like, my operatives aren't quite reliable. So maybe if you could lay out like a whole story for our listeners, that might be a useful way to help someone learn Warp Coven.
Well, probably I should use as an example my game with Jason.
Perfect. We love that.
So the idea is we were matched. Oh, what's the name? I think it's called. Oh, I have the cards here. Let me see. Sorry about that. Yeah, I think we were matched on hold in Into the Dark. So I looked at the layout and I assumed that a Phobos player would go for the rooms. Would go for secure and explore rooms. And Hold is a map that allows me very easily to go into the center and swing to one room or the other. And then after working out, I assumed that he will go for the rooms. I said, okay, the natural choice is for him to go recon. So my natural choice is to go, for him to go recon dash on scouting. And then I said, okay, if I just pick the scouting option that gives me attacker, I can just go and stop one of the rooms. Make it so that it's very hard for him to enter into one room and be sure that I can have enough presence on the middle to decide. That's when I decided the plan that works for that is security. If I'm having to thwart the opponent's plan, I decide where I have to be, and then I decide TACOPs that work with it. So if I have to invest heavily in the center, I go recon. I go security. If I suspect otherwise, a different opponent matchup that will just like go through the middle because it's easy to swing, let's imagine that on the same map layout, I'm facing Felgors that will be just trying to get a lot of value from their leaders' dashes to get a lot of early movement. I might not even want to face that. I might reverse myself and say, how do I thwart that? I can just flank him, try to steal his points, and go around him in the rooms. That's when I would choose recon and go for secure and explore rooms and even outflank. Because I typically run both icon bearers. I run the Sangor icon bearer and the Rubrik icon bearer. And that allows me very easily to score out flank just as I move from the point one. I'm just like going through the rooms, going to the sides, avoiding the big Horde coming through the middle and scoring as I go.
That's actually a really good point, is that the Icon Bearer just stands around and scores outflank, because you only need 4 APL on one of the edges to score it, right?
Yeah, and so it's it also makes it very expensive for the opponent to try to deny you that with both Icon Bearers. So again, that's kind of where I start trying to predict what the opponent would do, try to come up with what's my best plan to either avoid the big threats or deny him the points. So if I deny them the points, then that's when I see what tech ops might work for that.
Yeah, that was kind of one of the big points that I remember that you mentioned when we were chatting at the end of our game at Adepticon. Your whole plan revolves around predicting the opponent, and if you did that wrong, then there's a strong chance that you're going to lose. Yeah. I mean, you predicted my play very well. You had like the most flawlessly placed barricade ever. That combined with the ephemeral instability just 100% turned off my Alpha Strike.
And when you're talking about the Icon Bearer, you're talking about the Zangor Icon Bearer along with the Rubric Icon Bearer. So you effectively have 7 APL on both flanks that if your opponent has to go interact with them, you're like, that is fine. Because now if you go interact with those, my other pieces will blow those interactions up. And you've got a 5 of Invuln and, you know, good melee on both ends. So they stand still just fine.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, as Jason mentioned, like, I assumed... I had to make a roll, a mental roll of the dice to see, okay, he's going into this room, and maybe if I put a barricade here, if I activate my Temporic Sorcerer first and get the Ephemeral on the first action, and just go into that barricade, it will make it very hard for him to take that room, regardless of how many resources he throws into the meat grinder, right? So I said, I can easily change that. But if it fails, I say, if it all fails, at least I can swing back to the middle. Or get some support from the middle.
Okay. All right. So the security and the recon is kind of like a meta choice based on how you expect your opponent to be moving their operatives. When people are trying to funnel a bunch of dudes right down your gullet, like the melee horde teams, you're willing to take a little bit of positional play on recon, split the edges, and force them to pull out and separate so you can kind of pick your targets. Whereas, like, if they're going to try to flank you, you take a strong center and just shoot out at all your targets.
Yeah. Also force them to make a hard choice on the synergies. Because maybe they have to split their operatives, maybe in the case of Felgors, maybe they have to move their shaman away and maybe give their super concealed to fear operatives. So,
all right. Yeah, those are nice strategic choices, I think, for Warp Coven that, you know, sound pretty smart, I think. How have you been finding, like, when you were building up your skills for Warp Coven, what kind of, like, tiny tips and tricks did you pick up that were consistently very good that you still use? And then which things did you kind of find as those things kind of allow you to carry some of your games? So, like, you know, what was, like, the easiest stuff to learn and what has the harder stuff been to learn? Because I know Warp Coven is very challenging, so, you know, maybe some tips and tricks or some niche tactics that people can use.
Niche tactics. It's a double-edged sword because Warp Coven gives you a lot of flexibility so that you can actually think of a lot of different plans and you have the choice to execute them, right? And the problem is the opportunity space that you have to search for, right? I think that the best tip I could give to somebody wanting to try Warp Coven is experiment a lot. And it's fine. You will lose a few matches and it... Like, even in Adepticon, like, I tried something new against a team I haven't ever played. I said, okay, I think I will surprise him with this. I surprised them with it, but the plan didn't work. So I was willing to take a loss in an important game in the tournament and saying, okay, maybe I end up destroying my chances, but I'm willing to experiment and learn from it. That's what Warp Coven is all about. It's about like being creative, trying something new, and being bold in trying something new. If you stick to always the same strategies, you will find that you lose because Warp Coven is extremely unforgiving. If you always play the same strategy over and over, you are likely to end up being always playing rock. And when you meet paper, you'll be wrapped. Warp Coven gives you like maybe like a light rock, a rusty scissor, and wet paper. But wet paper might still win over a very hard rock. So again, experiment, be creative, go wild, which is kind of also potentially a hobby issue because you have to have a lot of Zangors. All of the Zangors have their place.
Okay.
There is always a map layout and a matchup where you will need the Hornbearer. There is always a matchup where you will want two Zangors with pistols.
Vicky.
So all of that. Yeah.
All right, so definitely a lot of experimentation. It doesn't sound like you're ever taking the SKU list of like 9 Zangors.
Hardly ever. Again, I might do it into Reachers. I might do it into Redguard. But it's all very sensitive to the matchup, the layout. I do like 6 Zangors. It's just that it was very hard for me to gig up on 2 spells on a turn.
2 spells a turn, yeah.
Yeah, if I don't need 2 spells on a first activation on turn point 1 and 2, I let go of the Icon Bearer. I value the Icon Bearer much more than the Gunner, for example. The Gunner, I had very poor results, like rolling 6 dice, getting 2 hits, and then getting the second shot, 1 hit. I cannot put all of my eggs in one basket. So that's kind of where I say maybe 2 Zangors give me more value. I can spread them out, I can block a door into the dark, or maybe I can do a double charge and kill something super beefy with the humble Zangor fighter with a pistol and a very surprisingly effectively Zangor champion that can't fight twice.
So all the pieces have to work in harmony for you to get the warp coven really going. It's not just like one sorcerer does all of the heavy lifting. Every once in a while, each sorcerer picks up the pieces from the other ones.
Yeah. That's also why I like the tome.
Okay.
It allows me to be a bit bolder in the sense that if I lose a sorcerer with the key spell I had for the matchup, I have a backup.
Redundancy is key.
It is key. I found that it's key to make a robust plan. If all your plan depends on one sorcerer, it's very easy for an opponent familiar with it to shut you down. Or even somebody that got lucky. That is, oh, this sorcerer looks cool. I will shoot it because it's the coolest piece on the table. Because it has happened. Like, some opponent says, oh, yeah, that thing looks scary. It looks scary. I'll shoot it. And then they get a good roll and they kill it. Yeah, so that's kind of why I say in Into the Dark, I most of the time take the Flux Blast spell in the tome on another sorcerer, and maybe I put one of each blast spells on different rooms. And on open, on opponents with high mobility, I might go for Ephemeral Instability most of the times. So it depends. But yeah, redundancy is key.
Yeah, so did you ever have any games where you didn't take Ephemeral Instability?
Where I didn't play it at all?
Yeah.
No, I can't remember from the game. There are games where I cast it on turn point 2. Like,
oh, okay. So yeah. Like you give it up on turning point 1 because you're trying to angle for a blast shot that your opponent might have to give you?
Yeah, or I make one just to feel them, to get the opponent to be confident and move forward. Like if I have a good guess as to what the opponent is going for, like if it's like one of those maps where there's very little distance between deployment zones, and I think, okay, they will go there, they will try to set up a charge. Maybe I want them to. And I'm not casting Ephemeral Instability on the turn point 1, I let them move forward, and then on turn point 2, I cast it, and maybe I can charge them without them charging me. Because their charges are too...
clever, actually.
So that allows me to call the shots. But again,
a way to steal initiative.
Yeah. The only time I've never cast it is when my Assorted Sorcerer gets deleted too early and I pick Blast on the second tome.
All right.
Yeah, I just remember that one game. Like it was like a few months ago.
I
lost
cool.
the Sorcerer too early and yeah, lost the Ephemeral Instability. That's the only game I didn't play. I wanted to. I couldn't, but I wanted to.
Yeah, I guess one of the other hot topics for the operatives for Warp Coven, since we're doing a deep dive today, is, of course, the Boons of Tzeentch, the individual buffs that your sorcerers get.
Do you also take the same perspective as you do for your game plans, that certain sorcerers, you know, you should be trying all of them, or have any of the boons become somewhat fixed on some of the psychic disciplines, like a destiny flyer or a blast flyer? Or is it still pretty dynamic in your experience? Because unfortunately, Warp Coven is one of the few teams in the entire game at this point that still has roster restrictions. Because when you put the sorcerer on your roster, it has to have a single boon and you can't duplicate boons.
Yeah. That's actually one of the things I got to experiment the less on. And mostly it's because I have three sorcerer models.
Okay.
So I have a few primed that I'm ready to paint, but yeah, but I'm very slow at painting. So essentially in my roster, I have Time Walker, which gives me one extra inch movement and one extra attack on the Temperic Sorcerer.
Okay. That's the Blast Sorcerer with ephemeral instability. Okay, so he's
and
like your
heal.
Backup.
And
yeah,
heal.
And heal. So he's like the melee guy that if you don't kill him in melee, he heals back 2d3, I think, every time.
Yeah, he can heal others. He can cast it on himself or on others. Yeah. So I want the 7 inches there to set up good alpha strikes. 7 inches meaning into the dark that you can just occasionally just reach a door, open it, and hurl a big blast at somebody. I remember my first game into cults was this January, and it was one of these layouts with a big wall in the midsection. Maybe it was channels, one of those. The sorcerer just moved open the door and hurled a blast, and cool, yeah. Big blast, 4 operatives, 2 dead, 2 wounded. So that's why I typically put the movement on that one. If I don't have a good alpha strike, I consider a lot the CP reroll.
Okay. The Patron of Destiny. Basically, that operative gets a free command point reroll, and every time you use it, you roll an extra die, and on a 4 or higher, you get to keep doing it once a turning point, and on a 1, 2, or 3, you lose the Patron of Destiny, and it goes away. So basically, just like extra rerolls across that model's lifespan. I don't think this is actually one that I've heard a lot of people use, so, you know, tell us how you use it.
Mostly, if I really, really, really need a Flux Blast to go well in my first activation.
Okay, so another Tempiric boon, sure.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I was going in this order. I typically have that on the Tempiric Sorcerer because maybe I give up the extra inch and I do a move and dash and finish in front of a door, but make sure that I get 1 free reroll and maybe another one. And the thing about Flux Blast is that it has rending. And it can be surprisingly good. And Into the Dark is little 5s. And I might do that anyway on open, regardless of losing the little 5 on open. If I see the layout and I see that a shooty horde has to try to gang up on a building that is slightly crooked, I might have a good chance to just do a regular move with a regular dash and hurl a blast somewhere. Okay. And that allows me to keep 1 reroll to maybe hurt an important operative, maybe hurt a leader, maybe hurt a medic on a shooty horde, which is very... It can be very painful to lose a medic if you depend on the shooting. So those are 2 things that I typically pair together in my roster. Then my sorcerer that flies with the bonus inch is called, I think, in material flight.
Yes, he gains fly.
Yeah, I typically have him on destiny, and I on open it's very good because it allows you to. I actually use it, I think, very heterodoxly because I use the buff to improve the reroll saves a lot, so that I can try to move around and steal objectives, and maybe survive a few shots. This discipline also has a spell that is 4 attacks, hits on 3s, little 5, mortal wounds 2, which is kind of like a weak sniper, but it's on opening, you can just hop on a vantage because you fly, shoot the spell, and go back in, but it's not a super strong spell. So it's good to shoot from safety. So that's kind of why I typically pair flying with that discipline.
Yeah, just to wrap that up, it's Destiny with Fly because you have two buffing and debuffing spells. So being able to fly, get around, lets you eyeball people properly because you only need visibility for Weave Fate and Twist Destiny. But that means that as a utility piece, now you can stop people from getting rerolls and give yourself defensive rerolls on top of vantage points. And then Doombolt, we only fire if we really need to because it's just not that reliable as a 4-tax on 3s, 3-5, effectively lethal 5.
Yeah.
It's okay, but it either spikes high or does nothing. And I think oftentimes when I fired it, it generally does nothing.
Yeah, it can be very swingy. So I cannot rely reliably on that shot. If it works, it's great. But many times it doesn't.
That's why you're willing to take a flyer shot where you're like, it's fully safe. I'm going to shoot and I'm going to be behind this piece of Octarius. So I'm not invisible anyway. So it's fine. So I'll do it then. But otherwise, you're using him to get into spots to help all of your other operatives act better. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, and I occasionally take also, I think it's Empiric Ward, which improves the invulnerable saves to 4 on that one.
Mm-hmm. Oh, on Destiny Sorcerers?
Yeah.
Basically, because if you Weave Fate, you get a 4-up save that also has full Relentless on your rerolls, so you can shot by a Plasma while in cover, and generally, I think on 4s with full rerolls, you make it out most of the time.
Or even AP1. If I have AP1, but I'm in cover, the Imbul Force with rerolls are surprisingly good. So
yeah, so it just turns your piece into something that you can like force your opponent to come out of cover for, and then you can respond with one of your gunners, basically. So it's just like a nice way for you to goad your opponent out. Something that I like doing, you know, because when you play shooting teams, you were talking about the medic is actually very good at forcing like shoot offs, but if you have a medic in the back, you can get out a shoot off, have a guy die, he disappears, and then someone else takes his place and blows up your dude that went to go kill.
That's a very valid point, and that's my exact thought process.
Yeah, no, I think that's good. I don't hear a lot of people talk about using the Empiric Ward this way, so this is some good juice. What else have we got?
My last sorcerer is typically on the Warfire discipline. So I bring all three disciplines all the time.
Okay. That's good. That's a good one.
I don't remember this year to duplicate in a discipline. I always bring the three.
Okay.
My last sorcerer on open, I would say almost always has the, I think, incorporeal side, which gives me little 5 and no cover. And then raid him with a flamer.
Yeah.
So that is very helpful to try to clear up an objective point, capture by an opponent, and cover. Excuse me for a second.
Yeah, so, you know, for anyone who's wondering, you know, the Warflame pistol, if you have incorporeal sight, you've got 5 attacks on 2s, 2-4, range 6, torrent 1, AP 1, lethal 5, and no cover, which means that most operatives are just going to take a huge amount of damage. And, you know, on In the Dark, you don't even need incorporeal sight, so...
Yeah, and that's why I picked the free mission action.
Appendage
on that same sorcerer in Into the Dark almost all the time.
All right.
I know that sometimes I even need to take the hit to get the no cover. And I just run it anyway in Into the Dark. If I anticipate the opponent to like go for 45 and I'm willing to go recon dash to steal initiative, I might still want them not to rely on those barricades. But most of the time I just take the free mission action on the Warpfire Sorcerer.
Okay, and that's for In the Dark, because on In the Dark your Warp Flame pistol automatically gets the lethal 5. So there's no reason for you to take a lethal 5 no cover. So your Warpfire pistol is switching between Mutant Appendage for door opening and silliness, and incorporeal sight on open so that you can blow people up who stand on objectives and think that, yeah, how bad could the shooting be? Because, you know, between the two of your attacks, you get a fair amount of blast 1 or slash 1 if you're doing it on the Warpfire discipline, because you've got your Firestorm and you've got your pistol. But maybe Firestorm is not a gun that you, a psychic attack that you use all that often.
I use it semi-often if I can do the Infernal Fire, I think it's called, where you target a visible opponent and everything you shoot into it gets rerolled.
Yes.
So that works well, with the Firestorm, because you're rolling five die, which means you get a lot of opportunity for crits, which are hard to block. So you can get decent damage on a sniper. Yeah,
and for people new to Warp Coven who've never played against a team, this is one of the few weapon profiles in the entire game that has indirect with no range restriction. So the Firestorm is just 5 attacks on 4s, 2-2, barrage, and blast 1 with indirect. So if he can see you, and he's not obscured, he's shooting you.
Yeah. Every tool in the Warp Coven list has an opportunity to be used.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's kind of what I like about the team. Lots of tools. You cannot bring all of them. But
you have many tools, but you only get to bring 3 of them in any given match. At least as far as the sorcerers are concerned, right?
Yeah.
Have you ever tried experimenting a little bit with the warp swell, where you increase your damage profile to 5-6 on a sorcerer rather than 4-6? Maybe against something like commandos.
Yeah. I don't bring it to a tournament a lot. Because again, I want a lot of Sangor variability,
mm-hmm.
But it's definitely good on against 10 mortal wounds.
9 and 10 wound models, right?
Yeah, it's definitely good. So I kind of like willingly sacrifice that and think of another way to go into fighting five wound wounds. Also, sorry, I forgot a very important thing: the weapons. On the sorcerers. Since I like a lot of models, the Temperic Sorcerer and the Destiny Sorcerer, they are running staff and Kopesh, so they don't have a shooting weapon. They can only shoot from their spells, so they cannot overwatch. That's actually hard. That's what I don't know if most people run like 2 sorcerers with the swords and 1 with the Warflamer. That's the way I typically run them. And sometimes I actually would prefer to have another sorcerer with a bolt pistol to get an overwatch.
This is a situation where you're a little bit roster locked and you don't have the space on your roster to have another sorcerer with a similar loadout with a bolt pistol, because you only get 1 boon, 1 sorcerer, right?
Yeah. So that's kind of where I'm actually thinking that I'm very interested in trying out a sorcerer with, I think it's called Crystalline, which means that your normal saves are 2 ups with a bolter and a staff, or having him on the second option, the warp swell. So that you have the bolt pistol and the staff with the warp swell. You maybe get less crits, you don't get the reroll, but you can do some shooting, and then you have a pretty good chance of killing an operative with 10 wounds. That's my thing to try to finish painting next. And experiment with that sorcerer. I think it has a lot of places where I needed it. Like after the game, I finished and I played my plan, and I said, this plan was inferior to having a sorcerer with the warp soul.
And this is really because you're losing out on a chance to charge, fight, kill a dude, be in a position where you shoot someone, and then have an overwatch to finish someone off. Because with two melee weapons, you're much more consistent in melee, but you give up the off chance to be able to kill a weakened operative and put yourself in a position for a new overwatch angle.
Yeah, that's one of the examples. There are a few others. I don't remember right now, but it happened to me in Adepticon. Like, I finished a game, I won it, but it could have been super, super easy if I had finished that charge and then be able to overwatch if the opponent fell back or something.
Okay.
So
yeah, I mean, it's a difficult team with basically a jillion options, and there's, I think every single Warp Coven player probably has a different idea of what they want on their boons and their sorcerers, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm kind of new and I don't know a lot of Warp Coven players, so I couldn't share ideas.
It might actually be one of these things where maybe because you don't have as many Warp Coven people influencing what you're taking, you were able to find stuff that works for your playstyle and kind of sculpt your own playstyle, which is something that not a lot of teams give you the option of, because I know that me and Jason have talked about how roster restrictions basically don't exist for most of the teams, but Warp Coven, your roster restrictions definitely change how your matchups play out as far as like the rest of the game goes.
And the thing I was just discussing is actually a hard choice for me. Like, bringing a sorcerer with a pistol I will put at least two different boons of cinch on it to make it flexible. It means I lose two Sangors. So it will be very hard. I will have to lose probably the Sangors with the pistols, because the sorcerer with the pistol will have to try to fill in for them. So hard choices. Yeah. I think this kind of boils down to the theme. I think it's very thematic because you have to have a plan for everything. It's very cinchy. You have to have a plan for every operative, and every plan needs all of the right operatives in your roster.
Yeah. Do you have a preference on which Zangor champion you take, or do you switch them off? Because I know this is another thing that I generally think people generally just take the Great Axe, I would assume, but it sounds like you play around with your Zangor choices a lot more than I have heard people do. So, you know, do you pick the Great Axe versus the Great Blade, basically passing up Brutal for Reap 1? Because those are the two choices there.
Yeah. Well, recently, I've been picking the Brutal one a lot. But that's because I've been planning to have the Zangor champion accompany a sorcerer.
Okay. Tell us why, you know, the Brutal work makes more sense with a sorcerer floating around.
Well, the problem is that the Zangors are glass cannons, right? They do a lot of damage,
mm-hmm.
but they don't have a lot of wounds.
Not yet.
Even then, with 9, it will be better. Maybe it will lean me to the Greatsword a little bit, the Great Blade a little bit. But the thing about Brutal is that it's much harder to parry.
It just makes your melee steps way more reliable. If you send in your champion to go fight two dudes, if you've got 4 dice on 3s, 4, 5, brutal, lethal 5, you're way more likely to deal with a single 8 wound operative, just because it's way less likely that they can parry out. Yeah. Whereas like with the Great Blade, they can just push one of your attacks out of the way, and if you only land the two hits, it's not enough.
Yeah, so the thing is that the Great Blade is very great at clearing up a door.
Mm.
Somebody, maybe they set up two operatives and they say they will have to waste a lot of time to go through this door. I've seen it. I've seen players just put two human operatives on the door. The Great Blade rips them because can't fight twice. You have the rip. Or maybe, for example, novitiates. Novitiates are very prone to putting a flamer behind a barricade with something else. You send the Great Blade in, you will cause a lot of hurt. But because if they go for parrying, at least maybe you get a few rips and you weaken them both. The Great Axe I typically take against more elite circumstances where they know that they could parry to try to outlive the Zangor. The Zangor, after all, has 4 attacks. And maybe lots of elites have 5 attacks. That gives them a lot of opportunity to outparry. I don't count on crits. I don't count to get the little 5s to pop up. So Brutal gives me much more reliability when going to elites. That's kind of my thought process on the Great Blade versus the Great Axe.
Yeah, that makes sense. Are there any matchups that you feel like this patch has actually helped you? Because, you know, we've been talking a lot about Warp Coven, how to get better Warp Coven, what your favorite things are. But now that we've have this data slate, you know, like the third in the row, I think that's pushed Warp Coven up just a little bit. You know, where do you feel like this patch has helped you out in matchups where maybe we're struggling? Like, do you see any games where you've lost or the games were close recently where these changes would have made the difference?
In my recent matches, I think that the babysitting range on the Icon Bearers gives you much more flexibility in positioning. So the way it worked before is that your rubrics have APL3 as long as they start their activation 6 inches away from a sorcerer. Right now, they changed it to be 9. So that means that if I lose a sorcerer, but I did my positioning right, another sorcerer can step in to do their work, but also babysit 2 rubrics. So that's something that would give me more freedom when I do my deployment. I can maybe be more ambitious when I try flanking strategies.
Yeah, and like the tether on the 9-inch radius is going to make for an 18-inch bubble, and that's going to cover like half the board.
Yeah.
Yeah, two sorcerers in the mid board basically cover almost the entire map. So one sorcerer can now go on the suicide run he needs to like kill a dude in melee and then flux blast and explode and kill a pile, right?
Yeah, or just steal a point. Maybe I realize early on that I need to really, really, really steal an objective that the opponent has on their backline. My sorcerer blue flies will just fly in, do their best, and the Rurik will no longer be sad to be alone. Somebody can come, like, motivate.
Give him a little pep talk.
Yeah,
rouse the spirits a little bit.
Yeah.
Let them know that there's more than just dust.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you are dust, but I still love you. So that's what I think will change my playstyle a lot. Then the next thing that will change me is that I will go for priest activation ephemeral instability less.
Mm.
You're
freed up.
Yeah, I might still do this thing about trying to position myself so that I do ephemeral instability on 10.2 to prevent charges, to be able to charge myself. Like, that's where I would, if I bring in 6 Sangors, I would play for that. I would try to cast ephemeral instability, then the Sangors horn bearer will do their horn blowing so that Sangors get 1 extra inch movement. So I might get some nice charges with the Sangors that now have 9 wounds. That would make that potentially more interesting now versus just going for ephemeral instability first activation 3.1 so often as I do. Those are, I think, would, off the top of my mind, the changes I foresee in my playstyle. Yeah. Anyways, I feel like I have so many options and like situations to speak about, and I don't want to worry with that. But yeah, it's like,
no, I think that's why you're here. You're our Warp Coven specialist as the Warp Coven hit their upswing. Cause I think basically for the last 2 weeks, Warp Coven have been doing reasonably well week to week. And I think they even did pretty well at Adepticon. And then in Spain, they had like a 5-1-1 record or like a 5. Yeah, it's basically they had 1 loss and a tie. So they were like in striking distance. I think they lost their final game to be in the podium. So I think there are some legs for Warp Coven players. And it does sound like people are using far fewer Zangwars than a lot of people have been experimenting with. Because the common meta choice has been that Zangwars are more important than Rubriks because they can stand around, do objectives, and they're reasonable in melee. But it feels like for the people who've been doing better, they've been hanging on the elite side a little bit more because now you can double shoot with your Rubriks and AP1 on double shooting is quite good and your spells are pretty good. So it feels like there's like an uptick on maybe there's a new conversion on what does work for Warp Coven, and it's not taking 4 or 6 Zangors all the time. It's taking 2 and then making sure that your tight hammer is pretty good while your Zangors just kind of force your opponent to interact with them.
Yeah. I do see that. I do see Exalted Astartes being free, incentivizing players to take more Rubriks and to go on the 6 Marine composition with the Rubrik Gunner, the Icon Bearer, and the Rubrik Warrior. I'm not interested in that right now because the Rubriks are very slow. And I don't try to want to rely on my dice rolls. I don't want to rely on my attacks hitting at the right time. So I try to place a lot of emphasis in positioning. If I only have 1 teleport, I'm teleporting the gunner or the icon bearer, not the extra warrior. So most of the time I will still think I keep that warrior down unless I see a game plan where I want a lot of overwatches. So I want like 2 shots from the Rubriks and then I get a few overwatches from them. But again, I will have to explore it. It's not the most enticing situation to me. I just want to keep around playing with different deployments in my same playstyle, just leveraging the extra babysitting range.
So
we've been talking a lot about Warp Coven, but generally on this podcast, we like touching base on a couple of teams. Are there any other teams that you've enjoyed, or maybe that as you were playing them, you thought that some of this play process could be incorporated into your Warp Coven playstyle, or has it been Warp Coven all the time, baby?
Yeah, for the past 4 months, I've been only playing Warp Coven. Since I'm relatively new to this game, I thought that I would just be consistent and try to learn it consistently and just try to get better. I want to be better, able to enjoy the game. I've been recently playing more Bedguard, Commandos, and Felgors.
A little bit of an amuse-bouche of teams that got nerfed today.
Yeah. I mean, to me, the Bedguard buffs seem a bit heavy-handed, but they will. I think they will still be a solid team. I've been playing those. Maybe I cursed them. Maybe it was Siege saying, like, no, you shouldn't consider them at all. Stick to Warp Coven.
Yeah, you attempted to flirt with some other teams, and all three of them got nerfed immediately.
Yeah. I like them, but I like Warp Coven the best. I've been playing them mostly to help some new players get experience. So I bring them because I think they are very... They represent a lot of the kill team soul. Like, Bedguard is a very solid, long game band. You want to, like, play for the long game, position. So it's hard to play because you have a lot of relatives for a new player. But at least I can show them how positioning works on a horde team. Commandos, I think I always bring them because there's a lot of commandos going around in tournaments, but
they cover like many aspects of the game very nicely, you know. Like, they're good at melee, they force you to interact with conceal rules so as far as like having a player learn how to play the game, you're like, look, I'm in conceal, this feels rude when I can charge you out of conceal.
Exactly.
The fact that you've got there's it gives you a lot of the feelings, and the models are cool, so you know, people generally, I think at a casual level, people are fine with commandos. At a very competitive level, people are sick of commandos. So it's good that they got I suspect it'll be good for everyone that they got touched. And then Felgor, it just shows you, like, this is what melee looks like.
Yeah. That's also why I was playing Felgor, to show them, like, okay, this is the summer of melee. Or it was the summer of melee until today. This is how a melee heavy team works. To be honest, Felgor, they are fun, but I don't play them a lot because I think I will get bored. I got the feeling that I would always play the same plan over and over again. That's not Sinch's way. That's just not. I really want to get creative. So that's kind of what I've been eyeing next, Blades of Cain. I think Blades of Cain
is very fun.
Yeah, they scratch that itch where you have a deep roster, you can adapt to different layouts, bring different operatives. I really like the theme, which is very important to me. I have to connect with the theme.
I quite like them. I've got my own Warp Coven that I think I'm going to dust off quite soon, just because I think playing with a six rubric sounds fun, and I have exactly, I think, 3 and 3, so.
Yeah, I mean, they will shoot very hard. Because AP1 in those three rubrics,
double shoot, it's definitely nothing to scoff at. And I'd probably be using the 5-up save and a 4-up save to like bait people out. So the 5-up save would sit in cover on engage and get the 4 rerolls in cover, while the 4-up save would kind of like sit in camp. And then the ephemeral instability guy would be in the back healing the two of them, because I'm pretty sure 5-up with 4 rerolls in cover can take a fair amount of dice.
Yeah, it can be swingy. But both sides, they can just be, you get like 2 4s, or you will be doing pretty well, and just a healing will keep them fresh throughout the match.
So I think there's some room there, and I've got the models, so I might as well play around with them. All right. Before you head out, it's a talk about your local scene. I know that you and we connected through Rob. I mean, obviously you and Jason played at Adepticon, and that sounds like it was very fun and very silly. But Rob was on here not too long ago and talking about the Dice Dojo. But if you wanted to give a call out to your scene or any friends that you've played around with in the past, you know, now's the time.
Okay, yeah. like I would say like 3/4 of my enjoyment of this hobby is my local scene. The people at the dojo, they are great, very personable people, very patient. They had a lot of patience when I was starting out. So yeah, definitely a shout out to Rob, that was my first game ever. A big shout out to Eric Miller, that brought Corsairs into Adepticon and had a very good run. I consider Eric my sensei of Kill Team. And my the good thing about my group is also that I think lots of them are also willing to experiment. So they come up with new bands, they try to be creative. I remember like the excitement when Inquisition came out, because I said, oh look, I can explore this, I can try Breachers, I can try Castlekill, and maybe they know that something is suboptimal, but they try it anyway. They want to like bring something new to every game. So like when I'm playing with them, I'm not super in a super competitive mindset. I know that we're just having fun and we're just trying to have a good time and like maybe even like learn one rule better every game. There is a very good banter going on at our own Discord channel. So yeah, all good things. A very, very friendly and amenable local scene.
Yeah, we'll make sure we got a link to the Dice Dojo's Discord in the chat for anyone in the Chicago area, if I remember correctly. Because that was actually where I visited, actually, way, way back in the past.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, any last things, Jason, that you want to poke our guest on?
I mean, I feel like it you've covered everything I was asking about. I mean, it really sounds like the takeaway is just, like, be a genius.
No,
truly
no.
The biggest brains succeed the most on Zinch.
No, it's not about a big brain. It's about, maybe it's about be a scientist, be a Kill Team scientist. Experiment, try it out. I definitely do not consider me a big brain player. I make silly mistakes. I misposition operatives a lot. I say, oh yeah, that guy is safe there, and they are not.
Yeah,
but that's where also where just like being patient and having being very patient and being willing to learn of every move and every opponent. That's my one big thing that I always have at the forefront when I'm playing. Just have fun and like yeah, maybe learn one cool new move or discover one cool new move or like see an opponent do a cool move and say, oh, what will I do now? What will I do next against that move? Cinch gave me Warp Coven to play with that, to come up with a plan.
All right. And as we know, it does always go just as planned.
Yeah. I know. Whenever I lose, it went as planned. Not as my plan, but somebody's plan.
Cinch's plan to tank the win rate to get these buffs.
Yeah.
It worked.
Yeah, it worked. Playing the long game.
All right, Alvaro, thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you a lot for having me. It has been a blast being here, sharing out the two main things of the Kill Team and also hearing your thoughts on all the meta and how our coming fits into it.
And thank you, listeners, for listening until the end.